Welcome to part two of my chat with Stephen Trask. Now, you probably heard part one. If you did, I don't have to tell you all the amazing things that Stephen has done and what kind of an amazing guy he is. And if you haven't listened, what's going on? Do you need some help? Do you need a hug? Go listen to it. You know, because we care. I care, he cares, we all care. And we all want ice cream.
Make believe, it's not pretend. We might be ill, but we're on the mend. It never starts, it never ends. Welcome to Craig and Friends. Welcome to Craig and Friends. Welcome to Craig and Friends.
So part of your worry was that your father would cast you out. And I'd like to mention now, again, my condolences on the loss of your father, which happened recently. You're welcome. Was there anything that made you think that specifically at the time, or was it just a general feeling that being different would be bad?
Well, that was the message. That was the message of America. It's not like anybody needed to tell you that being queer was wrong.
It was in the air all the time. It was constantly being broadcast. Yeah.
There was this joke when I was in college, and I remember being told it. It's not funny, but and it was sort of, and it was an AIDS joke, and it was about the shame of coming out to your dad. And I don't know if you know this or if you've ever heard this, but it goes like this. Dad, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is I'm gay. The good news is I'm dying.
I think I have heard that. Yeah.
You know, like that was like that. That was the time we were in, like,
right.
You know, and so there wasn't any, like, it was just sort of understood that queers went off to the city to live a queer life that was half lived in secret and was lived with their family relations at some distance.
Sure. Right.
That you didn't that they didn't know this about you. You kept it hidden from them and you lost touch. And then it's not, the exceptions proved the rule. I mean, it was not that's just how life was.
Sure. Right.
And so, you know, it wasn't anything like in particular that he told me or said to me.
Right.
And when I came out, you know, I came out as bisexual, just because I thought that was an easier thing to say.
Sure. Well, listen, Elton John did it. It all worked out. So,
yeah. And I remember, and it was a very big influence on me. I remember when he did that, and I was like, oh, he was in a picture of him in a bubble bath, and and he came out as bisexual, and I think I got an erection. I was at the dentist's office, and I was very young, but you know, and my dad was like, yeah, you know, I kind of knew.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean you knew? He said, well, last year, it was in my junior of high school, we had a Shabbat dinner, and before the dinner, I thought it was appropriate to read to my family the liner notes to Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On.
Uh-huh.
Do you know the liner notes?
I don't think I know the liner notes, actually. No.
It's sort of Marvin Gaye coming out of the closet.
Oh, okay.
As
okay.
Bisexual.
Sure. Sure.
But it uses the phrase, you know, sex between two consenting anybodies.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
My grandparents were there. And I just thought it was like, this would just come across as kind of like, you know,
a sophisticated,
like, sophisticated, free thinking kind of thing. And he was just like, oh, Stephen's coming out of the closet. Like, you know,
right.
He just assumed, and he was just waiting for me to tell him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
sure.
So you know, he wasn't really caught off guard.
Sure.
And I was not cast. I mean, there were ways that I was treated differently at first, but I was also like, you know, I went from being like, my dad would say, it's like, it's not that you're gay. It's like everything. Like you reach, you know, you quote Chairman Mao to me, like you look like a dirtbag hippie. He didn't say dirtbag hippie, but you know, you look like a hippie and you've got all these earrings and you know, like you were always toward the top of your class and now you're delivering pizza. Like I don't know what you're doing with your life. Like,
sure. It was more general confusion maybe rather than an antipathy towards your sexuality.
Yeah. It was just, yeah. But even during that, like, you know, we still went on family vacations and I still went home and we had nice times.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I think as the years went on of me living in New York, very hand to mouth, always having my electricity turned off, you know, my utilities turned off and I think there was a sort of general like antipathy to life choices that I was making.
Sure.
Not to do with my queer. I mean, my parents went to Squeezebox. It's not like, you know,
right.
Like they came and saw Mistress Formica, like they loved it. Like,
yeah.
Like but they weren't sure what the fuck I was doing with my life.
right.
You know, like
there was there was just a lot of like, yeah, I don't know. Like that kind of thing. Like, I don't know what's Steven doing. Like, I have no idea. That kind of thing.
Why is our kid who could be doing anything, who was like a star pupil and excelled at like everything. Why is he living hand to mouth in New York? Like,
yeah. Yeah. And also because parents get upset because they want to make sure their kids don't suffer in any way. And, you know, when they see you kind of not doing well financially, it just makes them crazy.
It makes them crazy. And they'd always been, you know, they'd always been like, you know, very supportive and like, you know, they were like the best parents. This is the thing is like the reason one, I think like it's easier. Sometimes it's easier for queer kids if they hate their parents, because then you can just go off and be queer and you're like, yeah, I don't talk to my parents. Like eventually, like maybe like you need to figure it out. But like you can go explore that stuff and it doesn't matter if they don't like you because you're queer or if lifestyle choices that you're making to perform in bars or whatever it is aren't really what they were expecting of you when you were growing up. Because you hate your parents. But like I didn't want to leave that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to leave that embrace. I didn't want to leave that relationship behind. That was like, to me, that was the thing that I feared the most.
Sure.
And
again, to point out the craziness of the cultural pressure, which of course still exists, but was so intense at that time that, you know, very supportive parents, you loved spending time with them, but yet because of the culture and the atmosphere of the times, you still had this deep-seated fear that was, you know, absolutely terrifying. Because what if that went?
Right, and it was just, and it was, you know, it was justified. Like people in the town knew, like they would like think differently of you.
It could even make you question the devotion of family.
Right, and but so I was cool with my family. Like that turned out to be fine, but you know, there was that period of just like I don't know. Adolescence of being like, did you ever feel like you were in the wrong body?
Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Yeah. Are you asking me
how did I get into, like, how did the me that is me get into this body with this?
With this mindset? With this?
I don't know. Something felt like off.
Sure.
Like not, something wasn't matching up.
Yeah. Well, I understand. I understand that in a different way. I had a lot of weight issues when I was younger because like you, I was bullied and there was a lot of going inward. There was a lot of hiding. There was a lot of things. Also not really knowing my sexual inclinations or sexuality fully, but always, you know, getting teased, called fag, things like that. And then also, you know, when you're heavy, you're not really doing much of anything with anyone. Generally.
No, I was heavy for like four or five. I mean, it felt like my whole life when it was there, but like I wasn't heavy up through fourth grade, six, seven, eight into grade. Like those were rough. Those were my chubby years. And those were bad. Like in fifth grade, maybe a little bit, like started eating in a closet a lot.
Sure.
Like eating tremendous amounts of food in a closet. I don't know if you did closet eating.
Yeah. When you say closet eating, you're being very literal, not just
literally meaning I would close the door. Like I would go say, I'm going to go get a snack. And then I would go and I would shove food in my face behind a closed door. And then I would come back to the family room with a modest snack on a plate.
Right.
Pretend that's what I'd gone and gotten.
Sure. Go ahead.
Did I ever what?
Oh, I know. I was going to ask if you ever had any eating disorders.
Well, I did. I did. I starved myself and like I would not eat all day because I did not eat all day my senior year. I I'd gained a few pounds in Peru, and then I became very obsessed with that, and so I would starve myself all day until I was like passing out. And the senior year, so I was a fucking mess, and I really didn't want to go to college. And even after I came out, I didn't want to go to, I wanted to take some time to put my shit together.
Sure.
And then I did go to college, obviously. I wanted to have an androgynous look.
Sure.
I like the skinny androgynous kids.
Yeah. No, me too. When you said the thing about, I don't know if it was exactly being in the wrong body, but like, if you look at some of the bands that we like, the glam era, all that stuff, that's what I wanted. You know what I mean? And then I did get thin, and then I went a little too far because it was kind of the thing of like, oh, well, I did get this thin. Wait, what if I sort of press it a little more? You know what I mean? What if I reduce the calories a little bit more and see what happens? And then that kind of gets into a thing. And I remember being in kind of an unhealthy place for a while with that. Yeah. But I similarly wanted that sort of thing.
Like, I remember my freshman year of college, there was a drag ball. And I remember everyone dressed up in real borrowed clothes and got makeup. And John, God, I can't remember John's last name. He was the most beautiful. He looked so gorgeous. And he was totally straight boy. Looked so beautiful in drag.
Yeah.
And I was jealous and in love. and jealous because I looked awful. I looked awful. I had hair in my chest and I had broad shoulders. And I just looked. I was hideous. I was the ugliest woman, and I was so upset. And then the Replacements had that song Androgynous.
Oh right, yeah.
You know, I bought that album just before, like right when it came out, and just before college, and I listened to that and be like, why can't I be like that? Like, why can't? So.
Sure. Yeah. I get exactly what you mean. But how did you sort of square the two things then?
How did I square the two things? I didn't for the longest time.
Sure.
I always felt like I always had very like weird body dysmorphia kind of things.
Sure.
I was fat. I would try to lift weights to have like long, thin muscles, and they would always bulk up, and I'd be like, oh, that's not really what I was going for. And like, so I'd do weird diets and I tried to, like, one of the things that was fun about Squeezebox was just like, it did give me the opportunity to dress up and put on makeup, and then doing Head Rig gave me the opportunity to dress up and put on makeup. And when my band Cheater put out a single, like, I remember we did photo shoots and I would dress up and put on makeup. They would bring stuff and I would love like putting on like the feather boas and
oh, yeah.
makeup. But it took me like, I guess part of it was like, because like was writing like was writing Hedwig, and I think like specifically Tear Me Down,
mm-hmm.
because like ultimately I think Tear Me Down is about like Tear Me Down states very forcefully that the gender binary is all in your head.
Right.
I mean, that was the point of the song. Before there was a speech, like it was used the wall as a metaphor, and then posited the notion that with Hedwig as being the divide between man and woman,
mm-hmm.
Hedwig could either be a wall between those two notions or a bridge between them.
Right.
And that without Hedwig standing between them, they like you would be nothing at all. Like the whole point was like you wouldn't, and then in this, that became more clear in the speech, but like you wouldn't know who you were in terms of like a gendered person.
Sure.
If you didn't have this division, you would lose all sense of, well, like, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but we didn't have the word non-binary at the time for gender.
Sure.
That's like, that is what it's saying.
Right. So the actual creation of Hedwig helped to unburden you of some things maybe that had been troubling you, or helped you to grapple with them?
Well, it helped you say it out loud.
Sure. It's always helpful to say whatever it is out loud, but a lot of times it can be hard if you don't know what it is to say it out loud, or rather how to define something.
Right. And it was interesting, like so, you know, Michael's an English professor, and English professors like deconstructionism had made its way into the PhD programs for English, and had come out of like French theory or whatever. And so like I'd never read Judy Butler.
I'm not familiar, so.
But she wrote a book called Gender Trouble, and it comes out of like of deconstruction, which is a kind of analysis that asks you to look at things in a non-binary way.
Okay.
To get rid of that sort of dialectical approach to philosophies, as saying it's either this or this and they are opposites, but to understand things on a spectrum. And sure. She applied it to gender. And I'm reading something she wrote recently, and it's like, oh yeah, like that's kind of what I was expressing in Tear Me Down. And I felt like the ability to take this thing that I was thinking about and put it into something that sounded like actually sounded like a real rock song.
Right.
And I don't know, like, yeah, it helped me, and it continued to help afterwards.
So like the continued performances, the more you did it.
Yeah. And like being exposed to it. And then like, you know, like, one of the things that Gender Trouble explores is the idea that gender is a performance.
Okay.
And like Wig in a Box is basically like is gender a performance?
Right.
Like that is learning to perform the role of being a gender that Hedwig chooses, and it feels like it's resolved, but it isn't really resolved for Hedwig.
Right.
In that moment, but it's exploring gender. It's exploring the notion that gender is a performance.
Right. And you mentioned Michael just before, and you met Michael in college, right?
I met Michael in college.
So, go ahead.
He was still 17 when we met.
Oh, really? Okay. And, how old were you?
I had just turned 19, like that week.
Yeah. Well, that's fair. I mean, it was a 2-year age difference then. I mean, really.
No. He turned, our birthdays are 3 weeks apart. So we met in the 3-week window during which I was 19 and he was 17.
I see. Okay. Thank you for clarifying. But before Michael, had you had any relations?
I did. I had a boyfriend in high school. After I had my talk with my friend David, I dated my friend Lee. I thought that we would both not go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And Lee was a really good actor. And I thought we'd both not go to college, and we would move to New York together, and he would try to be an actor and I would try to be a musician. That was my fantasy.
Yeah, well, that's a classic romantic fantasy.
It's a classic romantic fantasy, and I was sure that that's what we were going to do.
Sure, and also New York always being sort of the mecca for queer people, right?
And Jews. So
There you go. It ticks all the boxes.
So yeah. And for performers, and so I just figured we would go there, and we would just stay together forever. He didn't see it that way.
Alas, well, and again, now classic high school romance story. We're going to talk about classics.
It was a little more like a Brokeback Mountain sort of like, I'm not ready. I think I'm going to try being straight for a while.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. It's not so classic.
It's not so classic.
No.
Common. Common, but not classic. Unless you think like Brokeback Mountain. It was a very Brokeback Mountain sort of a thing.
When did you decide then to go to college?
So I didn't send any of my applications in when I was a senior. I just didn't. I really didn't want to do it. I told my parents I did. I didn't do it. Sometimes I sent the preliminary applications in, and I even did and I did the interviews and then I remember Oberlin, actually, I was going to apply to Oberlin, but I didn't. And then Gabby Schlesinger called my mother up and said, Myrna, Oberlin says they don't have Stephen's application and they've sent out their letters.
Yeah.
They lost his application. And we're like, oh no. And I talked to Gabby and then I spoke to some dean and they looked at my transcript and I did like this interview with them on the phone and they accepted me to Oberlin.
Wow. So your grades were that good.
I know. I had really good. When I say my parents were like, what the fuck are you doing? Not being able to pay your bills. Like, I had really good grades. Like,
yeah, clearly. I've never heard a story like that. I didn't put the application in. I had a phone chat. They looked at my stuff and they were like, yeah, come on in.
Yeah, come on.
Hop on in, buddy.
And so then, when everyone was getting their acceptance letters and my acceptance letters weren't coming, and my mother was like, she was just furious. And one day she calls up Wesleyan and she says, we're still waiting for Stephen's acceptance. They said, well, we have his transcripts. We have his letters of recommendation. We have his preliminary application, you know, like the one page thing you do, I intend to apply.
Oh yeah.
But we don't have his application. She got the same response from the people at Columbia. They say, he looks very impressive. We would like to have him as a student, but we actually need an application.
Sure.
My mother told the Wesleyan people, you lost my son's application. And then I came home and she said, you didn't send in any of your college applications, did you? And I was like, no. And she's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, she was so fucking pissed. She said, I just lied to the admissions officer at Wesleyan. I told them that they lost your application. I was going to sue. She was like, and they said, you can call them and you can get your application in now. I told them that they lost it. So I called them up, spoke to Dean Belt, told Dean Belt that I couldn't believe they had lost it. Fortunately, I had made a photocopy of it before sending it.
Yeah.
And that I would send the photocopy in.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I've got to go upstairs, write an essay.
Yeah.
Fill out a whole application. Go to the library and photocopy it.
Yeah, you got to commit to the con. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to commit. And I went down with my dimes to go photocopy at the library. And I was like, I really didn't want to go. And I was just like, and I didn't photocopy it. And then the next day, I put the original one in the envelope.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it was just on the other side of Connecticut, so it only took one day to get there.
Yeah.
And I got a call from Dean Belt. I'm a little confused. You told me that you'd photocopied your application and that we'd lost it, but now I'm getting just an original application. I'm getting an original document here that you just typed up. And I said, oh, you know, the thing is, when I went and looked at the photocopy, it wasn't a great copy. It was really hard to read. It was basically for my records.
Yeah.
But I never expected anyone to read it. And I just was thinking, oh my God, these poor people are going to be struggling to try and read this really crappy photocopy. So I retyped it for you.
It was very smooth. Very smooth.
And then the next day they let me in.
Because even if they figured it out, what's that?
What did you say?
Even if they figured it out, they were probably like, you know, the kid's really, he's got something. He's got a whole maneuver here. He's going to do well in the adult world and business. I think that's
He could be a real Bernie Madoff. He could be, who knows how far he can go.
One day, this guy could probably handle like 8 executives from 5 different production companies about a film that maybe he's not even that thrilled about. So I think we got to let this guy in.
Yeah. I like Little Fockers.
Oh,
I like
sure.
I actually liked it better before the reshoots, but that's another story.
Another story, but, sure. Lest I besmirch the glory of Little Fockers. I don't mean to, certainly.
No, you know, the thing is that the reshoots spoiled it.
Okay.
I'll just say that.
Sure.
Like, enough time has passed and it made enough money, nobody cares. But you know, Dustin Hoffman originally couldn't be in the movie. He was not available.
Okay.
And so there was this really gorgeous story where over the course of, and he becomes an absent father, like the parents were like divorcing his, like Fokker's parents were divorcing. And over the course of the movie, the De Niro character and the Greg Fokker character, the Ben Stiller character, they go from being enemies to being in this kind of in this like found family father son relationship.
Gotcha.
That was the sort of thing that like I would actually like cry.
Right, right.
It was so beautifully written, and to watch these people that for 3 movies had like hated each other become father and son at the end of the movie.
Sure.
Be full of love for each other was like, you know, it was really moving. And then, you know, studios, when they do their tests, one of the things they do is they ask audiences the question that will produce the answer that will get them the thing that they want, right? So so they say, what did you think about this movie, blah, blah, blah. If Dustin Hoffman had been in this movie, would you have liked it more? Would you be more likely to recommend it to your friends? How much more likely would you, you know? And of course, people are like, oh, yeah, if Dustin Hoffman were in it, of course I would like this movie more because it would also have Dustin Hoffman, and I like Dustin Hoffman.
You could ask that about any movie.
Right, exactly. It's like, So the reshoots were writing the Dustin Hoffman character into the movie.
Thus,
and there was wonderful stuff with him.
Yeah.
But the whole notion of the movie, the whole arc of the movie was about these two guys becoming father and son.
Right. Right.
And now you get to the end of the movie, and instead of tears, you're like,
yeah. Yeah. Right.
You know, like the whole, all the emotional, like, I mean, it was a really, like, I used to, like, I would watch the end scene over and over again, and I would tear up.
Which is remarkable, given how many times a composer has to see the film.
Yeah, and that went away. So, but yes, I scammed my way into Wesleyan.
and you met Michael.
And I met Michael. I was in this like hippie dorm, the like alternative hippie dorm where you had to like you had to answer a questionnaire to get into it. It's called West College. You had to answer a questionnaire, and it to basically show that you were some kind of free spirit. Maybe indicate that you did drugs or in some way alternative.
Sure.
And it was very, very hippie, But there were not any out gay people in the dorm. And I was very, 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 very closeted because it was this like very straight hippie culture. And except for John, when he dressed in drag, we had that drag ball and John was just so beautiful. And I was like, so fucking, I mean, you have no idea how beautiful this guy was.
Uh-huh.
And, and I still felt like I had all these friends, and if they found out I was gay, like you're out of it.
Yeah.
But Michael was in that dorm the next year, and every year some group of upper class people from the dorm would go and welcome all the frosh halls and kind of ease them into, or not introduce them to the idea of what West College meant as a, like a kind of alternative culture. And, which mostly meant like, you're going to have sex and here's what a bong is and here's how to pack a bong. And now I'm going to show you how to smoke a bong. And
this is the Grateful Dead.
Yeah. yeah, there were some deadheads. It was, you know, it was a little more like,
The Smiths maybe.
Well, no. So like, so Michael came and like our eyes locked. I was in the little group and with the bong and our eyes locked. And he had a friend who was very like, straight guy, but looked as much like a girl as a guy can look, you know, and loved to put on drag and the two of them were super queer together, even though one of them was straight and Michael was actually gay. And they brought the Smiths.
Oh, okay.
Brought the Smiths. And then Michael and I started dating, literally going on dates.
Right.
Our first date was to see a production of Twelfth Night. And we went on dates to see if we would give it a, to see if we liked each other enough, to like really go steady, I guess. We exchanged some clothing over Thanksgiving break. We were going to wear each other's clothing over Thanksgiving break. And then we're going to see each other the Sunday after Thanksgiving break. And we're going to figure out whether we're going to do this. We talked every day over Thanksgiving break. And that Sunday we're like, yeah, let's do this. And then the next semester he's like, listen, I'm not used to being, I did not come to Wesleyan to be in the closet. So either you tell your friends that you're gay and that we're a couple, or I'm breaking up with you. So I told my roommate Tony, and I was like expecting him to have some, actually I was going to tell him and like we were sitting down having like our first like hang. We were roommates and we were having our first hang since I'd really started seeing Michael, and he'd known that I was absent. And so this was going to be the time that I was going to tell him. And he said, so what's up with you and Michael? Or he said, tell me about you and Michael.
Yeah.
He said, tell me about you and Michael. And I said, we're seeing each other. And he's like, yeah, I know. I mean, like, what's he like? Is it a good relationship? Tell me about him. And I was like, oh, it's totally a different reaction.
Sure.
Than I was expecting.
Yeah.
And I think we were the only out gay couple there at the time. And then the next year, the next year was the queer year.
Oh, okay. It's a good year.
I will say that our coming out like helped make queerness part of the thing. I know it did because there weren't any out gay people before. Maybe there were years before, but not when I was there.
Right.
And it became very queer the next year. and then we had we had drag balls and it was, and it changed.
It blossomed. That's great.
It blossomed. It became the queer and goth dorm.
The best dorm.
Yeah, it was the best dorm. It was always the best dorm.
It was, yeah. But now it got spruced up a little bit. You know what I mean?
It became better.
It just became better. Exactly.
From best to even better than that.
Or bestest. And bestest. So then you do move to New York eventually.
Yeah. So I graduated. I moved to New York.
With let me guess, disgustingly great grades again.
No, I had terrible grades.
Really? Okay.
This pissed my parents off so much. I didn't care about my academics one bit. Like I had my things that I cared about. I wrote like the best music thesis. Like that's what I cared about. Like,
sure.
I got really interested in Chicago style free jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding it as more than just a music, but as like a cultural form and like something that came out of a long passed down tradition. And I spent like a year writing this music thesis and practicing with my rhythm section. We would have long practice. I arranged for a tutorial that I called Piano Trio, where me and my drummer and my bass player all got credit to just jam two nights a week for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And then I would write pieces of music and bring them in and say, can you play this? Let's play this. And I would write with the group. Like you're supposed to, like jazz musicians are supposed to, like jazz musicians would always show up in the studio after having written the record, like on the road, or you perfect it on the road, but we didn't have that. So I tried to like create the road through this.
Sure.
And my advisor said, you know, in his 20 some odd years at Wesleyan, it was like in the top three of music theses.
It was one of the bestest theses that he'd ever seen.
It was one of the bestest theses. And he didn't tell that to me. He told that to Mr. Kamens, who bought jazz records down at the record store where I worked. So I knew it was real.
Yeah.
Because he told it to somebody else.
Exactly.
And laid it to me.
Right.
So I was proud of that, but I literally, I got some A's, but I literally, there was a cutoff for doing an honors thesis, and I scheduled my concert for the next day.
Okay. And that clearly was more important.
No, it was specific. I wanted to say that getting honors meant nothing.
I see.
In like that. You know, everything was like, everything had to be a principled stand for me. So like in this case, it was honors has nothing to do with the value of the music that you make.
Sure. Okay.
I think I was a bit much. I was probably really overbearing and hard to be with.
Well, you know, it makes sense too. You sort of are struggling with all the things that we talked about before, right? And then you're finding yourself able to be your true self. And sometimes, you know, you get the bends a little bit in terms of how you handle that stuff. And also you're in, you know, early 20s, whatever. So that's perfectly natural.
That is the time to be overbearing.
Exactly.
Well, you know, and I was very politically active and I got arrested a lot. Like I had a lot, like, you know, my summer between my senior year and my freshman year and my first year and my sophomore year, I was arrested twice.
For what?
Occupying a federal building in Boston and blockading an Air Force base on the Cape.
Those are good. Those are definitely good. They're better than jaywalking or something like that.
They're better than jaywalking.
They are.
The second one was a Father's Day protest. So I called my father. It was like my parents are having a Father's Day, like, you know, event on the back in the backyard, and I called up from jail. Like it's like,
wait. And to quote was not was, you said, "Hello, Dad, I'm in jail."
I thought he would be like proud of me.
Yeah,
for having gotten arrested for a good cause, and that was like my Father's Day gift to him. So I was a bit much. So you know.
Yeah. So then, after that, to get back to New York, when you first headed to New York, what's your first job and apartment like?
My first apartment was a floor in a brownstone at 92 South Oxford Street in Fort Greene, which was between Lafayette and and DeKalb or Fulton. Fulton, I don't know which one. And right near the, there was a C train on one corner and then a G train on the other corner. The G was a very scary train at that time. It's like, you didn't want to be on the G train. And, you know, and I loved it. It was so beautiful. There was an actual crack house on the corner.
Oh.
Called the Moore Candy Shop.
That's great. Did it have a candy storefront on it? Or
it said Moore Candy Shop. It had a big sign over the door.
Yeah.
And then had, you know, display windows on the other side of the door that had curtains in them so you couldn't see in.
Oh, and
the door was totally like papered over or covered.
Sure.
So you could not see in to the Moore Candy Shop. But you know, that's where the addicts hung out there to get money so they could go inside and smoke crack.
Sure.
And, but like everyone knew what it was. It's not like
it wasn't
like a big secret.
Yeah. You weren't constantly going to the door being like, I don't know, I keep going to try to get some, you know, dum-dums and I can't seem to get in.
Right, they're out, and
constantly out of jujubes.
Like, you know, there were cops around. They knew what it was. They didn't care.
Like, yeah,
you know. So there was that, and you could, you know, it was at the time when, like, on the other side of the Fort Greene Park, there was a lot of gun violence.
Oh, okay,
mm-hmm. So for the other side of Fort Greene Park. Was one of the murder locations in New York.
Okay,
you,
gotcha.
You can sometimes hear the guns.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know,
it's New York.
It was New York, so like I loved it, and it was great. And then Spike Lee opened his office there, and I remember like watching him walk by, and it was just like. And then he walks, like in real life, he walked just like Mookie.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. So that must've been a thrill.
I was like, I'm watching these walks just like that. And then I started walking around like that. Like that was really stupid of me. You know, it's great. And I lived with a college friend, Jack, who was eventually in my band and then started dating John Mitchell years later.
Mm-hmm.
And with a really great jazz trombone player who had played in my thesis concert. I had one of the things I did when I was doing my thesis was I knew I wanted a killer trombone player because the kind of music I wanted to do had to have a really good trombone player. And there wasn't really anyone at school. And I tried to get my advisor to agree to do it. But I said, listen, I need someone who's just great. I need a ringer. I need someone who's going to make everyone else try harder.
Yeah.
And so I hired this guy. He gave me somebody's name and I was like nervous to call him. And I was like, I wasn't really sure. And then one day I was listening to an Oliver Lake big band record and I turned it over and I'm looking at I was like, I wonder who the trombone players are in this. And I look it over and one of the trombone players is this guy. And he was only like a year older than me. And he's already playing in Oliver Lake's big band. And
yeah.
So I just called him right up.
Yeah.
And he would come down for our band practices, like once a week. We would have really long practices into the night. It was great. Getting ready for that concert was like my bar mitzvah, that concert, and then Hedwig were like,
oh wow, yeah,
things for
milestones. Yeah. Yeah, so you're working with Cheater right at Squeezebox,
half of us.
Okay, so yeah, outline that for me. So how does Cheater start?
I had had a band called Bimbo Limbo Spam. I wrote a lot of good songs for Bimbo Limbo Spam. I never quite got it sounding the way I wanted. And then I was like in this bandless period. And then a friend of mine committed suicide, like an old family friend committed suicide, cousin OD'd. Like had some like weird life moments.
Yeah.
I was unemployed. And we're in this house in Brooklyn. We left the place in Fort Greene and moved into a brownstone that was totally undivided, so it could put a lot of people in it, and it had a bunch of sports.
Yeah.
And I started writing a lot. My mom was like, listen, I don't see you reaching for your goals the way you should be. Like if you're going to do this music thing,
yeah,
do it all out, because the last thing you want is to like have it not work out and then feel some kind of regret. Like you didn't give it your all.
Right.
Like it's one thing if you don't make it and you gave it your all, but if you don't make it because you didn't, you're just going to regret that your whole life.
Sure.
And then, so I started working really, really hard and I started like learning a lot of music. I was like, okay, I need to learn. Cause like all the, like, you know, my models for like, for learning music was always people for like writing music was you learn how to play the music you like, and that it should be really diverse. It should reflect the diversity of your own palette.
Yeah.
And then that leads to writing songs. And so I was like ready to move into a new phase of writing songs. And so I just started learning, learning things and writing things and learning things and writing things. And it would be like, I learned a Howlin' Wolf song. Mm-hmm. You're so sweet, you're so fine, how I wish you was mine. Which is not Jeepster, but it's...
It's a template for it.
Howlin' Wolf song.
Yeah.
Honey, I'll be your love, you be mine. And I learned Burt Bacharach's What Do You Get When You Fall in Love. I learned the Everly Brothers, Kathy's Clown.
Yeah.
I learned Alcoholiday by Teenage Fan Club. I learned, it was a very
wide spectrum,
of music.
Yeah.
And I got to the point where between learning those things and writing some stuff, I had like 5 hours of material.
Mm-hmm.
And I would play it. I had the piano downstairs, like an electric piano downstairs, and the guitar upstairs. And I'd keep going back and forth. And one day my roommate, Chris, was like, he was home. And he was like watching me. And he said, you need a band. You got to get yourself a band, because you've got like, 4 or 5 hours of material right now.
Yeah.
And if you don't get yourself a band, you're just going to have 9 hours of material. and I said, I was like, oh, right, I should get a band. You want to be in my band? He's like, yeah, fine. He was in another band. He's like, yeah, I'll be in your band.
Yeah.
And so I asked a couple people to be in the band. And we started, you know, doing gigs. And I was also playing in the subway. I would busk my songs. Like, mm-hmm. I would see if I could, busk my covers and then throw in some originals and see what would happen.
Yeah.
And I started like doing my kind of rock and roll piano bar thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
In some places. And that actually, like, I used to be able to like pack a nice crowd in places. I was really feeling like, I could write with influence by the people that influenced me, but just be out and gay.
Sure.
Which wasn't something that people were really doing.
Right.
Like the queer music at the time, actually there wasn't really much queer music at that time, because like the queer bands that came around a couple of years later were not out yet.
Right.
Like Pansy Division wasn't out yet.
This would be roughly what year? This is early 90s, right? Like 93, 94?
I think we started playing at it, and like I think we got together in like 91, 92.
Oh, okay.
And I just started writing songs with that were coming from a gay identity or a queer identity. You know, they didn't have to be punk or whatever. They were just from that identity. And then we had a single, and some gay media liked the single, and we distributed it ourselves, but we charted in some cities on college charts.
Oh, wow.
All I will say is that we charted in some cities. We were in the Northeast region. The single was like in the CMJ top 40 for like a a moment.
That must have been really exciting.
It was like, you know, it felt like, oh, this is a thing. This is going to happen.
Yeah.
And so I was also at the time I had started playing piano for a band that did this. They were called the Dust Brothers. No, not the Dust Brothers. That's a famous band. What are they called? I don't remember what they were called. The Something Brothers. It was two songwriters, and they kind of wrote in a kind of Robbie Robertson kind of vein, and the
sure.
band that they wanted to do kind of had that sound to it.
Americana type of.
What'd you say?
Like Americana.
Americana, yeah, and I could do that stuff. Like I was I was at the time a really good blues piano player.
Mm-hmm.
I tried a stint with Joan Osborne, but she fired me, and I didn't enjoy her band at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I did recommend to her manager that she cover a particular Captain Beefheart song, which became the single that got her noticed.
Oh, wow.
It was just like bar music, like playing like Janis Joplin songs and Aretha Franklin songs that were more about like hitting a groove, and then everyone took really long solos. And I just hated that. Like,
yeah, you know, yeah.
Like I hated that music.
Yeah.
Like I hated that bar culture.
Yeah,
that particular, it was very straight bridge and tunnel kind mm-hmm. of like, and I like Aretha Franklin, don't get me wrong.
Sure, of course.
Sitting there in some like pigeon tunnel bar playing the house that Jack built and being asked to play a 5-minute piano solo is like not what I had in mind.
Right.
And so I would play these, like, I would always do these avant-garde jazz solos that ended up with me playing with my fists and my elbows and stuff.
So it was like basically like you were playing Aladdin Sane and they wanted to hear Brown Eyed Girl.
Yeah. Yeah, I was doing my best Don Tolan impersonation. He was one of my favorite jazz piano players. And so I'm playing with these guys, the Beat Brothers. I don't know what the fuck they were called. And they were really nice guys. They were really sweet, but I just like, they weren't paying me enough and I was playing really hard. And one day they had a gig at Don Hill's and
oh, yeah.
the drummer didn't show up. And for the sound check,
mm-hmm.
we're sitting there getting ready to do the sound check. And we're all sitting there and everyone's really pissed. And Don's kind of pissed. And everyone's really pissed. And I'm looking at Don. I'm like, that guy's cool. And there was a bartender, Pat, and he was cool.
Yeah.
Really, really good looking. And I could kind of tell that he was gay. Even though I could tell that Don wasn't. And it was like, the place was totally empty. And I'm like, and I'm looking around and the bar just opened and I was like, I need to get in good with this bar. And
yeah.
And I kept thinking about the Beatles at the Star Club.
Yeah.
Just being able to just put on a show.
Sure.
Just play and play and play
yeah.
and play. And as you know, I had this huge repertoire of songs that my roommate had been like,
right.
You have 5 hours, now you're going to have 8 hours. And
yeah.
this was a couple of years later. So I had tons of stuff.
Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah.
And the drummer didn't show up. And so I just decided, you know what? I'm going to put on a concert for those two guys over there. And so I did.
Yeah.
And then I went and sat at the bar and they were like, that was amazing. That was blah. And I talked to Pat and so I have a band and Pat had just quit his band and I told my band was Cheater and I gave him our tape and the songs were obviously queer, but it was like kind of indie rock at the time or whatever
yeah.
they call it, whatever, alt rock at the time. And like, you know, we started to become friends and he was like, you know, I don't know any other gay musicians who play like contemporary sounding alt rock music who are also
sure.
gay. Well, you find out later that Maxwell's was just a big queer scene.
Sure.
With a very gay back room.
Oh.
Very coke-filled gay. queer. I'll just say it was a very queer scene. And all the bartenders were gay, and I became friends with all of them. One of them is my manager now. But it was a very queer. It was run by queers and the gay alt rock people
felt yeah.
comfortable being queer there, especially when they're snorting cocaine in the back.
And they got just a little extra comfortable
little extra
doing
comfortable.
That. Yeah.
But Pat and I felt like we were like kind of alone in this, like we're gay and we're doing this rock
sure.
thing. And he kept and And he was like, he kept inviting me. They were doing special nights at mm-hmm. Don Hill's to try and get the club going, try and get the club going. We're going to do a this night or a that night. And some of them just didn't fit. Like, it was soul funk night. And he was like, I want you to be the keyboard player. And I'm like, dude, okay, but I don't really know how to do that. And like, yeah, I went, yeah. Like, it was a disaster. I was awful. But he was like, I know I want to work. I know I want you to be a part of something here.
Yeah.
One day I was on my law firm job and I got a call from Pat. He's like, listen, we're starting a night. It's a queer rock night. There's going to be rock. There's going to be drag queens and a drag show and a drag hostess and trashy go-go boys. And we're going to have a rock band, a different rock band come in every week. And then we're going to have a house band that's going to back up a different drag queen every week doing a rock show.
Yeah,
and I want you to be the music director of that drag show. And this is going to be the biggest thing in New York. And I was like, well, no, it's not. Nothing is ever like I was sure I was like, oh, he's a really good salesman, but I was sure it wasn't going to be as big as he was saying.
Right. This sounds too good. It's not going to. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like everything. I was like, oh my God, this is everything I could dream of. So I went down to be the music director at Squeezebox. And it turned out to be like the biggest thing. It was like awesome. And I brought in the bass player from Cheater, who was the other gay member of Cheater. And we were half the house band. And then Cheater played there.
Okay.
We played there. We opened for Debbie Harry.
Mm-hmm.
So like I opened for Debbie Harry and then I backed Debbie Harry because Debbie Harry was the drag act.
Oh, she
wasn't
okay.
The drag, but it was her birthday.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a very fun night. So, and I don't think she'd done a full set of Blondie music in a long time. And we did all of these classic Blondie songs. And so I did a year there and then we parted ways. And during that year, we introduced Hedwig. John and I introduced Hedwig. The idea to create the Hedwig character came out of the fact that I was working there and we invented a drag character so that we could bring her there. Like, there wasn't a drag character in the show
sure.
before that.
It was originally about the Tommy character, right?
Yeah, and there wasn't a female character.
Yeah.
And John in his head may have wanted to do a character based on this babysitter, but there hadn't been anything written on paper or in any of the songs. We were kind of stuck. And then he told me the story of the babysitter. And I was like, oh, dude, that is a drag character and she's a failed nightclub singer.
Right.
And she stuck singing in dives. Because at the time, we still thought it was the rock singer. So the idea was that ultimately, when we were done with the show, she would have a scene that would be like that scene in Citizen Kane, where the once opera singer is now singing in dives. It was like
sure.
And then her song would be Wicked Little Town, like the song of being stuck.
Right.
So we invented this drag character together, and John performed it, and then we brought Cheater on stage to do Origin of Love, but the rest of the set was covers, and we played it with the house band.
Gotcha.
But we were just like trying to get the character out in front of people, not thinking that she would be the character, mm-hmm. but ultimately she would be just a scene or two
right.
in this other guy's story. But anyway, I did it for a year. And then they brought me back a couple of times for like an anniversary and also to be their band leader when Lena Lovitch came. They hired Lena Lovitch.
Oh, cool.
And they were like, listen, you know, we know you're not still doing this, but we really need you to lead the band for this one.
Sure.
So I came back and did a full set of Lena Lovitch with her.
That's pretty good.
Also awesome.
Yeah.
And exactly. I was like so stupid too, because like I've got an electric piano and like this crappy little like synth. It was like this, well, you, nobody can see me, but
like
it was
a foot long, one of those like mini Casio things.
It was like a mini Casio, like 18 keys.
Yeah.
And I'm somehow trying to pull off all those Thomas Dolby parts.
Right. Good luck.
It was so stupid. Like I was arrogant enough that I was like, sure, this is fine. Like now I listen back and I hear all the layers of stuff that Thomas Dolby is doing. And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. Like, how did I get away with
it? Yeah.
And I guess because it was just so loud and rocking.
Sure.
And Squeezebox was such a guitar oriented place.
Yeah.
That the keyboards always ended up in the background anyway.
Okay. And how, and you worked, and that was Michael Schmidt's club, right?
It was Michael Schmidt. So Michael and Pat started it together.
I gotcha. Yeah.
So Michael called Pat.
Mm-hmm.
Said, I want to start this club. Pat had Don Hills. They started it together. It wasn't just Michael. It was the
sure.
two of them.
Yeah.
And Michael's name was, I think, above the title, but it was definitely the two of them. And then Pat, Pat called Mistress Formica, I assume, and called me to be the band leader. I said, well, I want my bass player from Cheater. And he said, okay, great. I know a guitar player and a drummer to bring in. And so he got those two people. And Mistress was the first drag act.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who lined up the go-go dancers, but it was like, there was like that, and Miss Guy and as the DJ.
Sure.
And there was that group of us brought in like before it started.
Yeah.
To like get it off the ground.
You and John had met how long before? And it was it really on a plane?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was on a plane. You could probably find the date exactly because he was shooting a movie that Bob Shea was directing.
Okay. Isn't that interesting?
Book of Love.
Oh, yeah. I saw that a long time ago.
But at the time, it wasn't called Book of Love. And I cannot remember the original title, but let's just say it was called Book of Love, right?
Yeah.
And so we're on a plane. I had been babysitting for my cousins, and he had just wrapped all of his scenes on Book of Love and was going back to New York. And I was going back to New York. And the airplane was showing When Harry Met Sally, which I really liked when it came out, but Michael convinced me that it was heteronormative.
Not many people realize same plot as Hedwig. So now it's all being revealed.
So I wasn't watching it. And it was like, what the kids don't know is that there used to be TVs on the back of the seats or even screens that dropped down.
Right.
They had a projector and they projected, there was like the front wall of the section of the plane.
Yeah.
And they would pull down a movie screen, not like a TV screen, but like something you would show like something from an old classroom or something.
Yeah.
And they would project the movie onto the wall. And they're projecting When Harry Met Sally. And I was in the front row right up against it. And I was like pressed back. And I'm like, really did not want to see this movie again. And everyone's watching the movie and they're laughing. And I just, I'd seen it before. And so I was just looking for a place to move my seat. And I looked back and there was one row, there were three seats and only one guy sitting in it who was like really interesting looking and good looking and looked kind of queerish. I couldn't really tell, but I was just good looking guy and very intense.
Yeah.
And then two empty seats next to him. And he was not watching. He was the only person not watching the movie besides me. And so I was like, I'm going to go see if I can sit down next to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I said, is this seat taken? And he said, no. And I sat down and I had been reading Colder Than Death, a biography of Werner Fassbinder.
Some light material for the flight, sure.
Light material for the flight. And I thought, I'm going to put this on the middle seat.
Yeah.
And see what happens. See if it sparks anything. He seems interesting. He's got a black turtleneck. And now I was working and doing publicity at New Line Cinema at the time.
Oh.
So I was like a paid intern doing publicity. So I put this thing down. John looks at the book and says, you in film? And I said, no, I'm a musician. Are you? And he said, yeah. And I said, are you coming back from filming something? And he said, I am. I said, what are you filming? He said, well, you wouldn't have heard of it. It's I think it's still shooting. And I said, just tell me so I'll know when it, and he said, Book of Love. And I said, oh, the Bob Shea movie? He looked at me, he's like, what? and we just talked to each other the whole flight. And then we got in the A train, which, you know, that you could get at JFK. Mm-hmm. And he was living somewhere in Chelsea, not where he is now. And took the train all the way into Manhattan with him. And even though I lived in Brooklyn.
Oh, right.
Get back into Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So we just didn't want to say goodbye. And he gave me his phone number. He told me his phone number. He didn't have anything to write it down on. Told me his phone number, and I just said it over and over and over and over to myself, 213 something.
Yeah.
And it had a 5 in it, a 4, 546, maybe it was 546. I don't remember. So, the moment I got home, I wrote it down on a post-it.
Yeah.
Some little like piece of memo paper, and I put it on the wall in my little room in Fort Greene. And then every now and then I'd call him. Hey, it's Stephen from the plane. Hey, it's Stephen from so we were just like, we would talk every now and then, like every few months, we were just talking the phone. And then when I was working the slice counter at Two Boots, I remember there was this beautiful, the most beautiful boy in the world, this who was actually the original other half. Like he was like the main scene that John had. Two main scenes when we started working, and one of them, the other half, was potentially Jesus, and the other one was this guy, this most beautiful guy in the whole fucking world.
Yeah.
He folded boxes and opened cans of tomatoes. That's what he did, and swept. He was so beautiful. I mean, it was just like drop, like Leonardo, and he was so beautiful. And one day, and he didn't seem terribly bright, but who knows, because he was from Brazil. And so like, you know, you don't really know what the, you know, and he actually is this very smart guy, but like, he was so beautiful and
it was hard to discern because you're just blinded by the beauty.
Yeah. You really couldn't, all you could tell, he always like free balled. So you could always see like the outline of the head of his dick. And like,
oh, so more distraction, you know, on top of distraction. It's just like,
distraction,
you know,
of distraction.
You didn't stand a chance of getting any data. No.
I fell in love with him. I remember when there's this guy who lived across the street from us in Fort Greene, this classical piano player, amazing piano player, lived with my friend Johnny, who was totally straight until one day Leonardo was at our apartment.
Yeah.
And he met Leonardo, and he came over to my house, and he was like, he was just like, he was crying. He was like, I thought I was straight. I'm not straight. I have to have him. I can't think of anything but him. Like literally, like he was so in love with Leonardo. So Leonardo, one day he's reading 6 Degrees of Separation, and I'd never seen him read anything, and he's reading this play. And I said, what are you reading? He's like, I'm reading this play. It's 6 Degrees of Separation. My boyfriend is in it, and he's coming over for lunch. We're going to have a slice together.
Yeah.
I said, oh, okay, that's cool. I was like, oh, his boyfriend's in like a Broadway play. And then John Cameron Mitchell walks in the door. He's like, Stephen! So we hung out for a while. We went out for a couple times with Leonardo. We went out and just kind of drank and whatever. And then I didn't see him again for a while. And then Leonardo had another boyfriend. He said, do you want to come to the beach with me and my boyfriend? I said, John? He said, no, I have another boyfriend, but you have to keep it secret. And I said, okay. And then he started dating Jack.
Oh, okay. From Cheater.
And he was also dated a couple times this piano player, but that didn't really work out. Do you remember the Dueling Bankheads?
The what?
The Dueling Bankheads. It was a drag group.
No, I don't know them.
All right. Pause for a second.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Here, I'll look them up. What's a good sample video? The one from Gay Pride called "Why Am I Gay"?
No, okay. So anyway, he was also so when he asked me to the beach, his boyfriend was this guy David Ilku, who performed. I found out later when I was at Squeeze Box, performed in this drag group with a guy named Clark who passed away last year, I think, sadly, as the Dueling Bankheads. They were one of the original groups that we played with, and Leonardo's dating all of them. At the same time, and he dated Michael Schmidt too.
Wow, he got around.
So one afternoon at like after the band rehearsal, everyone's sitting around, and it's like Schmidt and John and Jack and David Ilku, and all of a sudden they all find out that they've all been dating Leonardo secretly, or he's been dating them all secretly. and they're just laughing about it, and then one of them says, "Hey, did he do that thing with the maraschino cherry?" Which, by the way, I have no idea what the thing is with the maraschino cherry,
sure,
but they all cracked up. He did it with all of them. He said, "I have this thing I want to do. Let me go buy some maraschino cherries." And he'd go down to the store and buy maraschino cherries. And whatever he did, I assume he stuck it up their butt or his butt. I'm not sure.
Sure. Yeah. It's better to left to the imagination, because then you bring your own story to it. No, it's it. And then also, clearly, he was doing it a lot because he had to keep going to the store. If that's one of the moves you pull, you'd think he'd keep a nice stock of maraschino cherries on hand. But he's blowing through those things.
I think maybe it was other people's houses.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He didn't bring the cherries.
I see. Yeah. Whatever you do, you make sure
the cherries is less spontaneous, right? Like, I have this maraschino cherry thing. Can I go buy some maraschino cherries? It feels more spontaneous than
totally.
I was planning this maraschino cherry event, and here are my maraschino cherries.
Yeah,
the bottle's half gone. Where'd they go? Like,
right. No, that's a good point too. So even if it was at his house and he had a stock of them, you wouldn't want to be like, "Hey, I just happen to have a lot of these, because guess what I do?" Right. Yeah.
Right. So then we hung out for a while with Leonardo, and then he disappeared. And then when Cheater started playing, I would drop off flyers for John at whatever show he was in. I would drop off flyers for him with a personal note. "Hey, it's Stephen Trask. I'm going to be at CBGB's with my band Cheater." And our posters were always very queer, gay kind of thing. And like, there's always a naked guy in the poster. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see a penis, but it was a naked guy. We had two naked guys went back and forth between. It was very eye-catching. And I would always write a personal note and bring it to the box office, and they would always give it to him. Apparently, I didn't know, because he never came. And I remember once he's like, "Oh, I can't go. I'm in this thing." But we talked on the phone, but he never came. And then, so I'm living in this house in Brooklyn, the year after Cheater had started, and I'm living with a friend from college who was a dancer, who had a very particular way of talking because he was raised in a deaf household.
Okay.
And he was part deaf himself, and it affected his speech pattern.
Sure.
And no one else in the world talked like him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on a subway one day, and he was talking to somebody, and John recognized his voice from across the train. John had been his camp counselor at an arts camp when this guy was in high school. Now we're both out of college.
Yeah.
This is the only reason that it's important that he has this voice. And so then they were like, "So what you up to? What music are you into?" He's like, "What bands do you like?" And David is like, I like indie rock and stuff. I'm really into this new band that you probably haven't heard of them. They're called Cheater." And John goes, "Oh, that's Stephen Trask's band."
Yeah.
And so David came home and said, "You'll never guess who I ran into on the train." And so then we started hanging out, the three of us, and then eventually the two of us just started like hanging out, and John bought me Plato's Symposium, and I read it and made that song.
Oh, wow. Okay. Then there we go. And then we're on the track to Hedwig. Well, yeah. Right. And so
it was this long kind of period of running into each other in weird ways.
Yeah. And that's great, because that's a lot of stuff that I didn't know about. Because, I knew the plane thing, and then you're playing a Cheater, and then somehow, it starts at Squeeze Box. That's kind of the condensed version. So it's nice to know that. It's a very New York story, actually.
It is a very New York story. There's actually so the night that John finally was able to come, we had really rehearsed hard for, we finally got a show at CBGB's,
mm-hmm.
where we had kept getting put off, put off. You know, like a band will know this. You would go down to Louise and she'd finally book you, and then she'd call you the day of the show. She said, "Listen, I'm going to have to postpone your show. You have to call up everyone on your mailing list
because
you'd get phone number lists, and then you'd have to call everyone and say, "Hey, our show is postponed. Hey, our show is postponed. Hey, our show." So,
and by the way, what would be the most common reason? Were you bumped for like another band, or what?
Bumped for another band.
Okay.
Yeah. It was usually like Sire has a band coming in.
Sure.
That's a big band. And Sire has a band they want to break, and they want that band to open.
Gotcha. Right.
And so they have to get rid of an act, and you're one of the acts they get rid of. Or maybe they got rid of two acts.
Yeah.
So you get bumped. But then one night Louise came to Two Boots, and she was really drunk with a friend. I gave her free pizza. And she really liked the shrimp, the barbecue shrimp with the jalapenos.
Mm-hmm.
And artichokes. I put artichokes on them. And so then I was working an afternoon. And one afternoon I was like, "Do you mind if I bring these slices to somebody?" And I made the slices that we made for her.
Yeah.
And by that time she knew my name.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I'd been there. She booked so many shows for me and canceled them that she knew my name. And I brought her the pizza. And she put two and two together. "Oh, you're the guy that gave me the pizza when I was drunk out of my mind.
Yeah.
And now you're bringing my favorite pizza. I'm going to book you on a great night with a great act. This is going to be a killer night." And I went all out calling everybody I knew to have them come to this night to really.
Yeah.
By that time I knew John. John and I were already hanging out. And so he brought his friends.
Yeah.
And one of whom is my manager, Steve, now. We really worked the social network. And then there was one of those blizzards that shuts down New York.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Like, it was like 12 inches of snow in like 4 hours.
Yeah.
And every band is canceling, and we decide we're going to do this fucking gig because they didn't cancel on us. We're just going to do it.
Yeah.
So, and we all got on the phone. We called everybody on the mailing list and said, "No, the show is happening. No, the show is happening." No,
right.
The show. And everyone came.
Oh, it's amazing.
And we had over 100 people at CBGB's, and they were all there for us, and every other band canceled.
Right, right. So, it's a blizzard, so to get anyone there.
Right. So we had 100 people there or more, and it was a blizzard. And everyone kind of, there were different social groups and people started mingling, and it became a party.
Yeah.
And everyone kept going to the bar and buying more and more drinks. And she was like, "You saved our night." and then she would, anytime I said, "Can we get a book?" And she said, "Yep." And we'd always get our night.
Oh, that's great.
That. But that's the night that John came and saw Cheater.
Now, there's so much more to talk about after the start of that, but we've been going for a while. So would you like to do another discussion sometime?
Okay.
I had a lovely time.
I had a lovely time too.
Good. And it was really lovely to chat with you again. I think it's been, I mean, we you know, text and stuff like that, but I don't think I've seen you since, last July.
Pride.
Yeah, exactly. Well, looking forward to talking to you again, and thanks for
likewise
being so candid.
Treat yourself right and head on over to patreon.com/CraigandFriends. Look at the reward tiers, see which one jumps out at you that you desire the most, and then just go for it. Grab life by the suspenders and pull at patreon.com/CraigandFriends.